everyone, and welcome to another edition of What's the Message. I am your host, Claudia Allen, and I am so excited here with my co-host, my editor-in-chief, my commander-in-chief, the one and only boss lady, she who gets it all done, my co-host, Carmela Monk Crawford. And I'm telling you, you know, we handle the heavy stuff. We do the heavy stuff here on What's the Message. I mean, we have talked about incarcerated youth near Richmond, Virginia. I mean, we have talked about race and racism. We have talked about police brutality. But today is a good one, because today we're just going to have some fun. Today we are going to laugh. And today we are going to get some nuggets from the infamous docuseries, The Last Dance. In other words, guys, we are going to bring you the hope in the Bulls headlines, okay? I'm telling you, this is going to be real good. We are excited, because I don't just have some basketball fans here. I mean, I've got some gurus and I've got my friends. So this is why this is just going to be a good time. I'm so excited and grateful that I have the Vice President of Administration for the Central Conference, Central States Conference of Sunday Adventists, Mr. Pastor Elder Kristen Josiah, the bishop, the preacher, the musician, just amazing, super cool dude. But then on top of that, I have my very own brother from another mother, the pastor Richard Martin, the senior pastor of New Life SDA Church in Hampton, Virginia. And so, listen, I'm hyped. Like I said, you can see, listen, I couldn't find my Bulls gear, so I had to just throw on some Nike. This is, you know, you just have to improvise, all right? But I am so excited. If you see this on your timeline right now, like it, share it, send it to somebody else, because we are going to go in and we're just going to have a really good time today, all right? Carmela, what is going on? How are you feeling today? Did you get a chance to kind of update yourself on The Last Dance, friend?
Funny. You know what? I'm scared and I'm embarrassed to admit I didn't watch all 10, but that's a sign of the times. That's okay. That we all are sitting around watching all 10 of this documentary about Michael Jordan. And you know what? The introduction almost went south there when you said we're going to find the hope in the bull. I was like, wait a minute. What do you mean here? The hope in the headlines, whereas we're talking about fans of Michael Jordan and the Bulls. Now, listen, this is my era. Michael Jordan, that was my sports hero, because I watched. And I thought we were going to come in on the Bulls music this morning.
Claudia. We did, but you can't hear it, friend. Robert told us. Yeah, Robert told us before we started. He said he redid our intro for us. So we'll be able to hear it in the playback.
We remember those days when we would come in and, you know, you would sit down and that Bulls music would come in and they'd have those lights. That was just so exciting. And the man would be like, Michael Jordan! And that would be me at home. Michael Jordan! But anyway, I did catch some of it. And I thought it was very interesting. You are right. There are so many different layers here. And there's a reason why we're talking about it right now. Because number one is the number one thing that we have to do other than go to church and worship at home. It's like, there, you know, there's no sporting events to watch. And except for reruns, my family has taken, my husband and sons have taken to watching the games, the computer video Xbox games on TV rather than even games. Wow. So anyway, it's that bad around here. But my question today, as we look at this documentary, I think it says a lot about not only the icons in our collective history, what they mean to us and why they are the icons, and so many different things about the kind of things that we value. And I think looking back, it's easy to be revisionist and it's easy to sort of redraw the lines of what Michael Jordan meant to us here now, 20 years out of his heyday. But he was the man back then. Talk to me about the enduring legacy of this, first of all. Before we tear the man, I'm not tearing him down, but you know what I'm saying. Kristen Josiah, come on, talk to me.
Uh-oh. Well, So as
and I'm picking on you because I saw that jersey that you had on in the
you won't see this jersey too often as a Laker fan. So for full full disclosure, Laker fan right here. I did not like Jordan. Another disclosure, I was a, what you call a hater coming up back in the day. I rooted, even as a Laker fan, I rooted for the Detroit Pistons to crush him. You know, so I even got Detroit Pistons jerseys because I was such a hater, even though I was a Laker fan of Michael Jordan. But yes, I think today, I think Jay Williams from ESPN said it best. There's a dichotomy in what you see from him. It's a docuseries, but it's really his series versus what you hear from other players. So we'll talk about his championships and how driven he was. He had a one track mind, which was to win, you know, to win at all costs. And I think today we can talk about how is that how God would have us to move, you know, win at all costs, or is there a better way, you know, to win? And so I just thought I'd start out with that.
Richard Martin, please tell me you are not a hater.
No, not much of the imagination. Am I, was I, or have I ever been a Michael Jordan hater? I will say this. Kobe Bryant is my favorite player in the sense of my life and times. I grew up in the 90s, but I caught Kobe on the back end of the 90s. And so he's the one who's carried me through, you know, adolescent, teen, tween years. You know, I watched his last game, all of those things. So Kobe was my Michael Jordan, but I was very clear on the fact that Kobe stood on the shoulders of Michael Jordan. And so I've always had an appreciation and a love for him. I do think, personally, he is the greatest player. I think he changed the game in an unquestionable way. I've worn and have pairs of his shoes, Bulls hat right here. You know what I mean?
Oh, Lord.
I appreciate the game. I appreciate the craft. I, like many 90s kids, watched the VHS tapes that would come out on him, tried to mimic his, you know, mid-air switch layups and all those things. So not a hater at all. I thoroughly enjoyed the documentary, and I'm excited to dive in together with everybody on it.
Oh, my goodness.
Listen.
You are like me. We are Michael Jackson people as well, aren't we? Michael Jordan.
Oh, listen. Yeah, absolutely.
You know, that's another thing. So,
listen, we can talk about Michael Jackson one day too. I'm with it. Listen,
oh, yeah.
I think I said this in a sermon that I preached at Richard's Church, actually, because I preached at Richard's Church, as always, first weekend in February. That is our, it's nailed until the coming of the Lord, just wherever he pastors. That date's already taken.
First Sabbath Black History Month.
I'm chilling with Richard and Kyla, and so I went over there in 2020 this year, and it was literally on the heels of Kobe's death, and so I remember preaching a sermon and just kind of mentioning that I was born a Bull, born in Chicago. My mother is from the west side of Chicago. My father from the south side of Chicago. And so I was born a Bull. My father was actually going to play professional basketball. But he ended up tearing a crucial ligament and could not get to the Utah Jazz draft. And one of his best friends was an Adventist guy that he used to play basketball with on the street, my Uncle Kevin. And so while he's healing, he meets Jesus and becomes Adventist. And the rest is history. But in spite of, you know, and having never gone pro, you know, my dad poured basketball, like drenched basketball into me and my brother. And so I absolutely remember growing up and watching Michael Jordan play. And like Richard was saying, just absolutely grew up with Kobe. And so Kobe Bryant and Michael Jordan are kind of like just integral to just significant moments in my own personal life. And of course, as I guess our viewers might not know, I actually played basketball growing up. So, you know, I was hardcore Lisa Leslie fan, was trying to be the only chick in Berrien Springs that could dunk. Could I? No. Not even a little
bit. Past you, Claudia.
No, I mean, I could grab rim, but okay. I couldn't get to that point. I got a bad knee injury and my dunking escapades were short-lived. But all of that said, I am just super excited for this because basketball is life. Hashtag basketball is life. Yeah. So as we kind of think about this, in the beginning of the documentary, I think what they did, which is kind of interesting, let's put a pin on Jordan. I think what they did is they kind of started out with other players, right? So it's like, you know, we get a little bit of Scottie Pippen, we get a little bit of Dennis Rodman, as well as kind of an engagement with Michael Jordan in correlation to them. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that absolutely shocked me in the beginning of this documentary was that Scottie Pippen was literally like the sixth best player in the league, but was literally like the least paid athlete in the league. And my mind was blown by that. Do you guys feel as though, based on what you saw, do you feel like this was a fault of Scottie Pippen's, or do you feel like this was a fault of the league? And I'm just wondering, you know, like what lessons can we learn from his experience with never being paid his worth?
I think that Scottie Pippen was an institutional casualty, which happens probably more than we realize, where the business model and structure often overshadows whatever contribution the player makes. Players have been time and time again shown that they are not indispensable. They are valued, they are appreciated, their contributions on the court are highlighted. But being on a highlight reel on SportsCenter every evening is not the same as being compensated for what you bring to the table. They didn't go into as much detail as they could have if, say, it was a Scottie Pippen, it were a Scottie Pippen documentary to show who was in his circle, who were some of the voices around him, who were his agents, what guiding presence did he have to be able to say, hey, you don't have to settle for this. You don't have to go for this. You can actually negotiate. So that's the institutional side of it. I think he was a casualty because of the machinery that was at play. Like whoever drew up that contract was not thinking primarily about, hey, you know, we can't do this to this guy. They were saying, hey, listen, if he signs it, it's on him. And so that's the second part, because it is on him. There was that piece of the documentary where they said that he had a choice. He could have said, you know what, I'm going to hold out for something else. But maybe Scottie thought to himself, if I push back, they could easily pull the contract off the table and I miss an opportunity to play with Jordan, to be able to pursue a championship. So maybe for him, it was the fear of the unknown, or fear of missing out, and the uncertainty about if I kind of stand up and say, listen, I'm worth more than this. So I think ultimately it's a blend of the institution took advantage of him and maybe some ignorance on his part, but also his own choice to say, we'll see what it's going to be. Looking back, he has 6 championship rings. His name will forever live in sports glory connected to Michael Jordan. Did he make the right choice? That's up for listeners to decide. But I think it was both and.
Yeah, just to add to what Richard said, I think it's very interesting that Scottie Pippen, since you brought him up first, has decided that he would not even speak. He's not doing any interviews based on this docuseries, even though Jordan himself said, I think in a Hall of Fame speech, he said that he would not be where he was unless he had Scottie Pippen.
Right.
So there is a, he's like the best Robin, you know, Batman and Robin.
Yeah.
So he's like the best Robin ever, but somehow as this thing is portrayed and Richard talked about the contract issue, he could have demanded more, but whoever he was, you know, had talking to him, they allowed him to go ahead and take what he could at that time, which was a terrible contract. I think even the owner said that he would have advised him, you know, not to do it. I think Jerry Reinsdorf mentioned that. But that being said, you know, it's kind of unfortunate that the collateral damage is real, and you see it, and even in now, you know, this has been what 20 years since, and there's still a lot of tension, a lot of friction there with Scotty, and if I could add Horace Grant, DJ Hodges, there's a lot of guys that are like, you know, that's his portrayal. But unfortunately he was collateral damage, but he's got the six rings, you know, right. you can't take the six rings away from him. But it's unfortunate. And if I could push it a little bit, collateral damage happens even, you know, in other institutions. Can I dare say the church? There's some people, you know, who say, well, I don't mind, you know, going through this or that or the other. And in my mind, you know, we've got to be a little bit stronger individually, even though we are part of a body. People talk about the team and all of that, but we've got to have a central core. There's got to be something in us that says, no, we will not stand for this, or we will stand up against that. And you don't see Scotty doing that during those years. And it's unfortunate.
And see, that's funny how your perspective, you know, you say, you know, you I guess extrapolate that and look to us each individually to assert or have a stronger core, as you say. Yeah. My thought initially was, yeah, Jordan could not have done this without Scottie Pippen. And they were like this, and there was no, in terms of the play and on the court and everything like this. And I look and I extrapolate that and say, well, you know, the idea of team and team for me is not just that we're all working together, but we're all looking around and seeing how can I strengthen the people around me? Right. How can I look out for the people around me? Right. You know, Jordan with it, you know, all of his might, all of his commercial success and influence, you know, it's like, how can you have the guy that's helping you get there not have what, you know, is his due? Mm-hmm. I think that's interesting. You know, when those many years ago, just as a side note, I thought it was interesting that right in the middle of those playoffs and championships, we are watching these so closely. Michael Jordan's name was the one that was so well known, but anybody else, you could come on. And we had this joke where I used to work, where we'd call the lady at the front desk, and we, you know, you get more points if you could get her to page a famous person, right? And so she would not recognize. So one day we said, could you page John Stockton? And so, you know, she paged him. Nothing happened. And so we're like, okay, I got one. I get more points if I can get her. He said, can you page Scott Pippen? Nobody, she didn't get it. She didn't understand it. And next thing we hear over the microphone, Scott Pippen, could you please call 2314? Like, what?
Jokes.
Yeah, wow. Well, hey, I got the points I won that day. But the only reason I was saying that is that the same part of the team was just, you know, no, not the same level. You know what I mean? Unless you watch it. And then I just feel like team and everything that we do, that's such a value for me. Anyway, I would love to hear. Well, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Claudia.
No, go, Carmel. You're good.
I was just going to ask along those lines. I was saying before that Magic Johnson commented on Michael Jordan's leadership style, which I thought was very interesting. It never occurred to me that this leader, this winner who he is, that there is an opposite way or another way of looking at successful leadership other than what he did. What can you tell us about what you observed in that leadership style and whether you think that can apply to some other things or shouldn't apply to some other things?
Richard, you want me to go first?
Yeah, man.
I'm the first last time. Whew, man, so that question has a lot of layers to it. I mean, it's a lot of layers. And so from a winning perspective, Michael Jordan's mindset, and this is coming from a hater, but his mindset was kill or be killed, you know? So he got stronger going through Detroit. You know, there was two or three years where they couldn't pass, you know, the Detroit Pistons. The Bad Boys would just beat him up, man. They had Jordan rules were in effect. Mm-hmm. You know, he couldn't come into the lane without getting a body on him. And what did he do? He went in the gym and he started lifting weights. His upper body, I know it's a whole lot of basketball stuff, but since we're talking basketball. Okay, so his body got stronger. His mindset got stronger. So anybody that came into that Bulls team, when Scottie got drafted, when Grant got drafted, came in, his mindset was we have to be mentally stronger than them. Mm-hmm. Not just skill level, we got to be tougher. So by the time the Knicks came up and the Pacers, these are all tough teams. These were strong teams. But by the time those guys started hitting, by the time they got past Detroit, they had the mindset. And so MJ, you got to give it to him. I think about Paul, Philippians, I think Philippians 4:13. One thing I do, I press toward the mark. He was so locked in and driven that he was mentally stronger. He was physically stronger. And so when the testing times came, they were able to rise eventually above it. So I've got to give it to him for pushing them. Now, is there another way as a leader that you can push your people without, you know, and this was something that I had a hard time with going through this thing, you know, the language, you know, that, you know, why ESPN couldn't just hit the mute, you know, it's regular television. It's not like it's a rated R, you know, there's some movies I haven't even watched because I'm so particular with my family and with my own, you know, self, you know, and so he was driven. He had that one thing I do mindset, but the way he drove them, and, you know, some people would say it kind of didn't work in some instances because, you know, well, he got the rings, but again, for Pippen, we talked about Pippen, you know, he was so messed up, you know, mentally, I think, that there was one game against the Knicks that he sat out the last because he wasn't the one taking the last shot, you know, which is something that, you know, you say you never do. You stay in there with the team, but some things he wasn't able to teach them, even though they won. Whereas with Magic's leadership style, again, a Laker fan, with Magic's leadership style, he comes in the league, he's playing against the Boston Celtics as a rookie, and he's able to guide his team. You would never hear people on the Lakers organization saying anything negative about Magic. Was always smiling, he was always cheerful, he was a floor general. And he literally carried Kareem, got all his, you know, five or six of his rings because of Magic, you know. Mm-hmm. And so different leadership style. And I think you can take the good of being singularly focused and kind of leave off some of the negative about, you know, the tearing down, the berating, that kind of thing. And so I try to pack a whole lot into that.
Yeah, that's good. That's good.
The documentary was fraught with leadership lessons, as Kristana said.
Yeah.
And when it comes to leadership, one of the questions is always, do the ends justify the means? And the ends that we all might agree upon, which means do we agree upon? Mm-hmm. I think with Michael Jordan, what the documentary emphasized, or at least magnified, was the head office, the coaching staff, and the players all wanted the end of a championship. We want to win.
Right.
I think where there was difference and at times dissonance was the means to get there. And it really seemed, now this is powerful because Michael Jordan was obviously far and away the floor general. He was the captain of the team. You know, everyone's clear on that, but he wasn't the coach. He wasn't the owner. He wasn't the general manager, yet his presence infused all of that. If you watch the interplay between Michael Jordan and Phil Jackson, it was very interesting because there were times where Phil had to assert himself and say, listen, I'm the coach of this team and I recognize you're the captain, so I'm going to hold you to a standard. And so I think that there was this back and forth in terms of whose means are we using? Michael Jordan's one track mind. I have a singularity of focus. We're going to win by any means necessary. I agree so much with Kristan in that. That whole by any means necessary can be printed on a t-shirt, you know, somebody has a tattoo somewhere on their body. It's just like this mantra, but it's not without its loopholes.
Yes.
Because that's at right. The moment where, and we saw it, you know, where Michael Jordan, that highlight, this is for many people, the highlight of the series, that emotional scene where he's saying, listen, you know, I have a way I do things. If you can't work with me, if you can't get down with me, then then we can't play together. Break. You know, he's crying. And he's saying, this is my way. And I think that, again, people will always praise that way because of what it brought. Things. But it's not the only way. And from a leadership perspective, and I think inevitably we all were gleaning leadership lessons.
Yeah.
I think I was inspired by what can come when you do have one option. In other words, if he had given himself two options to say, I might win, I might lose, we might not see what we have. He said, no, I'm only going to win. And I think that's powerful. I think when you say, listen, this is what's going to happen, I'm not giving thought or energy to anything else.
Any other scenario.
That's great. But at what expense? Am I going to make it personal, am I going to, you know, grow my church by any means necessary to include my wife and my family? That, you know what? They'll understand. You'll just have to get down with it. You knew what you were signing up for when you married a pastor, you know, all that kind of stuff. And at the end of the day, sure, you might have, you know, a couple articles in Message, Adventist Review. You might speak at a few places, a couple federations. But in the final analysis, when it's all said and done, you know, and they put the camera on your wife, is it going to be like, is she going to say, yeah, but he wasn't here? My friend circle, you know, will they say it was really rough to be around him because he just didn't prize? And I'm glad they didn't shy away from that. That moving part where he and Steve Kerr got into it. And he said he felt so small. I think that was probably one of those moments where he said, Mike, come on now. Like, you're so driven. You're trying to get there to the end. But is this what you want to do?
Right.
You want to be physical with your teammates. And so I think even Mike, you know, if he were to look back, you know, and he did. He called out himself on some moments to say, yeah, you know, I didn't do everything correctly. So even that part is a leadership lesson. When we look back and as leaders, we say, you know, that probably wasn't the best way to handle that meeting, or I shouldn't have said that in that way or that at all. To own it helps us as well to grow.
Absolutely.
That's so good. You know, the thing that I was thinking about too is it, because I hear what the, I think what both of you are saying as well. It's like, do the ends justify the means? But there is a part of me that also is like, do we see, like, do we have any other example of individuals that attain that level of success and fame without being a jerk? Like without.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Doing all, you know what I'm saying? Because sometimes I look back and I'm like, whether it's musicians or artists or, you know, whether it's intellectuals, whether it's athletes, there's this tendency that usually these larger than life people have this very, I'm so one track minded. Your feelings are absolutely irrelevant to the situation. You know, show up or show out. And even the moment that Richard brought up, while I was watching Jordan literally become emotional as he's talking about saying like, yo, this is what it is. Like, almost like, I don't know how to do this any other way.
Right.
I genuinely felt bad. So I was sitting here and I was like, man, you're such a jerk. Like, but then at the same time, I'm like, wait a minute, he's crying about being a jerk. And so it's like, there was this kind of dichotomy or this conflict of him being like, I want to have this end and I don't feel like I know any other way. Give me grace. Richard, I see see your hand
I just want to hop in on that because he said something that I feel like was kind of a key to his mindset. And he said, some people might say my leadership style was tyrannical. You know, somebody might say, oh, he was a tyrant or, you know, he was very hard. But he said this, he said, well, that's you because you've never won. And when he said that, I said, wow.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Same.
never won anything. Yeah. I was blown.
So Michael kind of opened up, you know, himself a little bit more to say that uh-huh. that what's informing my approach is when I tasted winning, mm-hmm. you know, not mm-hmm. just games, not just personal awards, but when as a team, we won that first championship or getting through the playoffs, you know, hitting Detroit. So I think it's both and. I know yes. the pain of loss. That's mm-hmm. no fun. But I also know the thrill, what is it? The thrill of victory, the agony
victory,
of
victory. The fate. Yeah.
I know the thrill of victory. And I feel like in a certain sense, victory can be intoxicating mm-hmm. and it can kind of further fuel and motivate that tendency to say, listen, I know what it's like to taste victory and I want it again. So I'm willing to say, forget feelings and all those kinds of things. And so I just wanted to jump in on that to say, yeah, I felt like there was a little bit of high self-interest in that moment, but I had to acknowledge for him, you know, for anybody who's criticizing him who don't have one ring, there's always going to be that ability for him to say, listen, I have six. So yeah. you can say what you want about what was the wrong way. Show me your right way to none of your rings. You know what I mean? Like you didn't get one. Now, I'm not saying that that's right. I'm just saying for him, that was his mindset. For me, my proof is in my pudding. My way works. And I don't have time or I'm unwilling to try another way or anyone else's way. And so, but to your original question, is there another way? Is there another figure? I think yes. Mm-hmm. And
yes,
I might be, you know, forgive me. You can call me what you're the pastor. You got to say that. I think Jesus is the best leader. Okay. I think
of course.
He models emphasizes the best approach to leadership to where his end was very clear in his mind. Was Jesus a passe spineless leader? By no means. I mean, if you read scripture, you'll see very quickly and clearly that he said some things that probably did not make people feel the best. One of those examples was, you know, Jesus, I want to follow you, but you know, let me go bury my father.
Oh, that's a good one. Like, yeah.
You know, let the dead bury the dead. Follow me. Yeah. Like that has to sound like the most insensitive, inconsiderate statement, right? You know, and we can go on and on, but I still think that his emphasis on developing persons, his patience as a leader, his boundaries that he placed around himself and other people, his risk-taking, John 4, you're talking to a woman? Like, Jesus, what's going on? But he knew what he was about. So I think Jesus does become, not just in the spiritual realm, but even people who don't profess to believe, read books such as Leadership Principles from the Life of Jesus, right? And I feel like ultimately he models the premier leadership principle, which is self-sacrifice. You know, at the end of the day, I'm going to put the team ahead of myself. So that's one. And then I think even in the sports world, there are leaders who they might not have accomplished all of the feats that Michael did. Mm-hmm. But if you were to just look at them for their leadership, you do see people taking persons from one step to another, galvanizing their team without berating them, without breaking them down. And so I think that they are out there. Michael Magic Johnson, as Kristina said, is one of them. I would give some of that to LeBron James. You know, I see in him more of that Magic Johnson DNA where, you know, I'm going to be myself. So that would be my two cents on that.
Yeah.
Very good. You know, I can't find a higher example than Jesus, man. There's nowhere else to go but down. From that narrative, and I'm gonna tell you, Jesus was tough even on people in his inner circle, you know, and so I think Jesus shows you that there's a toughness, there's a look, man, you know, you're gonna have to take up crosses, where I'm going, you can't go, even though you're talking like you can go, but then he also knows how to bring them along as well, which is more of the magic. And I'll even say this, I would even say to Kobe, and I know this is not about Kobe, but as a Kobe fan, I can't help but just drop his name right in.
Go ahead, drop
his name. Okay, so Kobe is considered by Lakers players, Lakers greats like Magic and Kareem as the greatest Laker. A lot of it comes from the driven mindset of an MJ. So he patterned his game after Michael Jordan. But and Shaq would even tell you this, when Shaq was coming into the league out of shape, and I know some of my Shaq lovers ain't gonna like this, But Shaq would not, you know, he wouldn't drop his weight before coming into practice. He was practicing while the games were going on in 2000, 2001, 2002. Kobe was really the one that was carrying the team close. And then when, of course, he got to the playoffs, Shaq now is in shape and he's dominant, you know. And then you fast forward to the Kobe's back-to-back years of 08, 09, and 2010, where now if I call names like Jordan Farmar, nobody knows who that is.
Right.
No. Vujicic, nobody knows who that is. Paul Gasol, some people know who that is.
I got you.
But Kobe's now carrying the team, and he's as tough. You know, he's, you know, I don't know what language he used in the locker room, but he probably was like Michael Jordan there too.
Probably so.
You know, but you don't hear the same kind of Rick Fox, you know, Derek Fisher, you know, all these guys that are sitting there and the funeral. I mean, I'm still getting over you know, that this whole rest in peace time. But you find him being able to push and pull. He's like Jesus, he's pushing, but he's also pulling. So he's not, real quick, there's a story about, I think there was a Nike, there's a Nike meeting that he had at the headquarters. And Kobe is so driven that he gets to the meeting early and he doesn't have a suit on, but he has sweats on. And he asks the people at Nike, is there like a basketball court somewhere that I can go put some shots up? Now he's going into a business meeting. You know, might've been dealing with his shoes or whatever, you know, some kind of contract. And he's so driven mentally that he's going in there, he's taking shots because he never asks from his players what he didn't do for himself. And I think Michael mentioned a similar statement. I think it's either episode 9 or 10 where he said, you know, I never asked from my players what I wasn't willing to do. So when he was doing sprints, Jordan was leading the sprints.
That's right.
And they showed some footage. You know, this is the 97 to 90, you know, 90 season. He's the old man out there and he's running sprints ahead of some of the players, you know, and so there is a way that we can push and we can pull. And I think, you know, like Richard said, Jesus encapsulates, I believe, that servant leadership where I would even die for you. But I'm gonna show you how to live. You know, I'm gonna lay my life on the line. I wish I had three organs.
Y'all getting hyped.
Look, I lay my life on the line. On the first day of the week, I'm gonna rise so everybody can rise. That's a whole there's a whole gospel story and narrative, you know, that we could talk about, you know, Romans 5, where he literally justifies the entire world. It is finished. That's bigger than just, you know, Jesus died on the cross. You know, he does something that nobody else is willing to do, like only he could do. And he drives us, but yet he pulls us.
Yeah.
That's something that I've learned most recently about when you're talking about the leadership style of Jesus is the inquiry, that personal inquiry. So many times he asks those questions that hit the mark on the sore spot sometimes, or the sensitive spot. And just the area that says, you know, I see you here. I still love you here. You're there, but I want to ask about this. You know, so I think about that woman at the well, where in polite company, I might never say something like that. You know what I mean? But the question is, where are you? And this is one thing that I've learned in some leadership training that I've had about, you know, ask the question, what are we doing here? Where are we going? Not in a way to bring people down, but in a way that says, let's take a moment, let's take stock, let's understand what's happening and how we'd like to move together. Not so much of a dictatorial thing, but, you know, a thing we're asking together. I'm going to ask one last question, but then I want to pivot to something slightly different. Well, a lot different, if with your permission, I could ask you before we go. But I wanted to ask you a few moments ago, Richard Martin, you were talking about, you know, am I willing to do this at the expense of my family? And, you know, and what is and Claudia and you and I were talking What about the idea of the absence of Jordan's family or his wife in particular? I mean, we saw a lot about, you know, how his father was influential and the grief that he dealt with after losing his father. That was very sad. What do you think about that?
Go ahead, Richard.
From a journalistic standpoint, I think that they made some boundaries. And I'm sure it was in dialogue with Mike. That did become very clear after about four episodes. I said, okay, they're really going to keep it basketball right now. You know, again, I don't have any hard and fast facts on why those decisions were made, but I just think that it was the decision of the directing team and probably of Mike and others who contributed to say, here's our focus. But it wasn't without themes that, you know, we might be able to not necessarily come to our own conclusions simply by way of inference, but for instance, I'll give an example very quickly. That portion of the documentary which talked about how, in his opinion, this is not a lifestyle to be envied, you know? That the fame comes with a certain price that people think they're willing to pay, but they really don't. They really don't know. In that theme, very broad theme, there's probably some implications there about how such a lifestyle, be it just A, playing basketball all year, and then to be far and away the most recognizable sports figure, probably of any sport in the world at that time, one can only imagine just the kind of experience it was for his family. But I just think in terms of the basic principle of why they weren't featured, I think that some journalistic decisions were made and they chose not to go that way.
And if I can add to that too, so there's a little bit of a difference between, you know, a basketball player driven by winning success, you know, the championship is the end goal. Versus when you come in now to pastoral ministry, where there was a time when numbers was, that was the end goal. You know, regardless of whatever's happening at home, if you produce, you get put on the pedestal. If you produce, you get the big church. If you produce, you know, you get to be in the conference office. You know, I don't even know how I got it. I'm so driven in a different way. So family, you know, Jesus talks about, you know, I think Ellen White talks about the first flock, you know, and the question is asked, where's the flock that I have given you, you know? And that's not just talking about church members. That's talking about, you know, my family. So my wife, my kids, you know, and so there's a little bit different end game, you know, than just a championship when it comes to, or should be, when it comes to ministry. Wherever we are, we ought to be servants. Wherever God places you, you ought to be a servant, you know. So the servant mentality, which makes and of course the prize, Paul talks about, you know, pressing toward the goal or the prize toward the mark of the high calling of God in Christ Jesus. Being like Christ is the goal. Being with Christ is the goal. Being in the big church is not the goal. Being in the conference office or being at the division level or the GC.
Well, you know, even you're not talking about the church at all, and you're talking business in your life, your whatever your calling and your career is.
That's it. That's it.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, so our end goal, and I'm glad that Paul says it. Paul says that we run to win a race where everybody gets a crown. I'm going to be like Oprah. You get a crown and you get a crown. And you get, you know, there is not a singular. So there's only one NBA championship that you can get per year. There's only one person gets that. Paul says, but we all run in a race that we all can win. And so the mindset, though, we need to be driven. And I think, again, there's something to be said for him being driven for that one thing. My goal is to be like Christ. So my role models in the Bible are people like Enoch. Doesn't get a lot of shine, but he got so tight with God. God was like, man, I need you to take him with me. That's my guy. That's my dog, you know. And so there's some people in the Bible who may not be as popular, but they were so driven to be like Christ and to be Christ-like that's to me, that's our goal. MJ's goal, you know, was a little bit different, you know, and I dare say this, were he not driven in that mindset, it's very possible that we don't get the six rings. If he wasn't driven, Because remember his, I don't want to say baggage, but his background with Detroit was we're not letting you into this space. And that informed that fight. Because when he came out of North Carolina, I think Dean Smith said, you know, he was the most talented guy that he'd ever seen. You know, so coming into the league, you know, he dropped, what, 60-something points on Boston Celtics.
Right.
I mean, they weren't winning. But as far as talent, he had it. You know,
right.
But I understand him from, you know, again, a hater. I understand why he did what he did. I rooted against him in every series. I thought the Pacers should have beat him. I thought the Knicks should have taken him down. I thought Utah Jazz, you know, with Stockton and Malone, and they weren't scared. Stockton wasn't scared. When you see Stockton's play against the Bulls, he wasn't scared. Malone wasn't scared of Rodman, you know. Yeah. And I was like, man, he should have. You know, and every time I went home, you know, and I was in high school going into college, and man, let me tell you, I had to eat a whole lot of crow. I had crow, man, six championships. That's a whole lot of crow. Yes. But I have come to respect his being able to focus in and lock in, you know, to achieve that goal. I think we have to recognize that our goal, you know, as leaders in God's church, our goal is different. Our goal is not earthly, is not singular. You know, and we have to make sure that we're not conflated. Unfortunately, you know, we've seen, you know, people in leadership conflate the two, where they're driven by policy and politics. We've seen it, you know, and then some of us who rise up against it, we're called the black sheep, you know. We're you know, and it's just that our goals are different. You know, it's not that somebody's good or somebody's bad, but, you know, we're just driven differently. My goal is to be like Christ, you know, and if God uses me in various, you know, places to for me to still achieve that goal, then so be it.
Mm-hmm. It's funny that I was going to say, I see a lot of people online who are really resonating with your perspective on Michael Jordan. I think this is very interesting, all of you who are writing in. I never did root for him either. I think all of y'all are revising history now, because we all still wear his stuff. Everybody, you know, so all of you, all of y'all online right now. But I guess my thing is, I also see a lot of support for people where people are saying, you know, it was Scottie Pippen was the one that rounded out, so that, you know, we are not all expected to be everything to everybody and have all of the virtues that appeal to everybody every time. But that's why we move in concert as a team prayerfully. I guess we're talking in life, you know, give and take here and there. Go ahead, finish your thing. Then I'm going to come in and bounce to something slightly different. Go ahead, Claudia.
I actually want to take it a different direction right before we kind of end. I really do want to touch on mental health before we kind of close.
So can I ask you before you close too, before you go there? Go ahead.
Okay, go ahead. No, ask your question first. Okay. What's your question?
Here's my thing. Quickly. I'm looking really quickly at some of the information. They have this movement out in Chicago this weekend where they're opening a mega church. And they are so solid on the idea that you cannot, you know, governor, mayor, you know, health department, you cannot tell me not to worship. And you are infringing upon my rights and my constitutional rights to worship and to gather. Both of you, since we got two pastors on the line today, I sure would like to know, one in administration and one in a local church, what are your thoughts about this? And are we looking at something that implicates the conscience here? Because I think that's the line that I guess we don't want to cross. But is that where we are right now?
Richard, you want to go first?
I will go second. I defer to the administrator. I have a comment to make, but I will defer to you.
Real quick, you know, this is, for me, this thing is not about about policy or religious liberties. And I'm saying that as the public affairs and religious liberty director for my conference, that this is about my people living. And so most of the cases of contact spread that have been shared came from churches. Most of the dynamic spread of this virus comes in places that are enclosed in worship centers. And so as we've told our pastors here, you know, church isn't closed. The building might be closed, but church is open, you know. Mm-hmm. And so our churches are focused in, they are locked in on doing ministry. We have a lot of food pantries. We were blessed to get 25,000 from the NAD, ACS, to bless our pantries, to be able to continue to feed people, because a lot of people who are out of work, you know, 30% unemployment, and a lot of people who need food. And so we are looking at doing church differently, no matter what happens with the virus. You know, mm-hmm. So the typical, you need to be here, even the way that we're administrative, we meet with our pastors, you know, every Monday to get best practices. We share with them what's going on. They share with us, here's what's working in my area. And so, yeah, we're not driven. We don't see this as infringing on our rights at all. In fact, you know, we look at it, especially with the African-American population being the highest hit, as if anybody's going to be overly cautious, it should be our people. Mm-hmm. That's kind of how we look at it.
Awesome. Interesting.
I agree wholeheartedly with what Pastor Josiah said. I think it's a matter of interpretation. I'm not familiar with the name of the megachurch in Chicago. I think it's probably one amongst many who feel as though the church is closely tied to the physical plant. Mm-hmm. And I'm not here to disparage physical plants. I actually think that meaningful experiences happen. So, you know, I'm not on that extreme. It's just like, it's not the building. Buildings matter, yeah, just like families occupy homes, and those houses have memories, and you know, right. they have a place. But it is not the primary expression of the church. The church is a body. It's a movement, and that is not confined to a building. So interpreting it that way, for me, I don't feel like our consciences have to be so challenged at this point, mm-hmm. by governmental and for our context, conference guidelines, which say, hey, listen, don't open those doors. I think it's safe. I think it's being mindful of people. I actually think it's in line with our mission in terms of serving mm-hmm. people. It might yes. be a disservice to people yes. to open up prematurely and place people at risk. So I agree with what Pastor Josiah said.
Yeah.
Man, there's so much that we really did not even get to cover. I really wanted to talk a bit about Michael Jordan's kind of aversion to social political engagement as well. And, you know, potentially what ways did that potentially kind of impact whether or not he would have been as much of a global sensation as he was. But I think I'm going to choose probably a more important diversion that I want us to have, and that is around mental health. I did feel as though there was so much in the documentary that did not explicitly deal with mental health, but had a very significant underlying current towards it. Whether that is, you know, Michael Jordan's father being murdered, then there is the conversation around Steve Kerr's father being murdered. Mm-hmm. And then just dealing with Scottie Pippen, you know, when they talked about Scottie Pippen's background and association with how much he was paid or not paid, they talked heavily about the poverty that he grew up in and how he came to the league really trying to say, hey, I do not want me or my family to experience the kind of abject poverty that I grew up in. And so I'm going to sign this 18-year contract that really is not beneficial to me in the long run, but provides some kind of stability that I know I can't, you know, kind of get out of, right? So it's like you have individuals that are, you know, making business decisions out of fear. You have other individuals who are, you know, Jordan seemingly leaves the league and goes into baseball as what I would borderline say, basically as a poor decision around grief management, because his father loved baseball, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now he's trying to be the best baseball player in the world, right? And so I just would, you know, really love to kind of hear you guys' thoughts. I know Rich kind of mentioned it a little earlier as well. You know, Michael has this moment where he says, you know, everyone wants to be like Mike for a day, maybe even a week. Yeah. But, you know, I challenge someone to be like Mike for a year.
Right.
And, you know, he has several moments where he's crying, you know, at the end of championship games, he's rolling on the floor, just weeping in tears because of the emotional and physical exhaustion that he has exerted. And so it's just like, there's just like constant moments and scenes that just have me wondering, you know, is his drive, is what we see on the court a result of poor emotional management, a lack of, you know, stable emotional health, a lack of therapy and counseling? And how important is it that men in general get counseling and get their mental health treatment, but Black men in particular? What do you guys think? I know it's a lot. It's just that I'm running out of time.
That's right. Okay. I think that you're right. There were mental health issues and realities that, if not explicitly commented on, just by way of whatever they covered, I think we all saw it. Dennis Rodman. I mean, that whole, I need to get away and go to Vegas
Dennis.
And lose my mind, then come back and play sports. Absolutely. Or just the need to express oneself in greater and greater ways of extravagance, measures of extravagance. And where does that come from? So that I think that there is a connection between tragedy and triumph. I think that from a male's perspective, being in some kind of context that involves competition and conquest, that is an outlet. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there is this verb, this drive that is brought to it. And sometimes it might not be perceived as unhealthy that I need to create controversy to drive me. I need to make up something that flips the switch so now I can be who I need to be, right? Mm-hmm. And so there's the whole idea of what is normal, that I call normal, but not might not necessarily be the healthiest, right? So you do have, and even just one step back, the macro, which is you have all of these guys coming into this thing at young ages, right? Mm-hmm. So you're in your early 20s, all this money, all this attention, all these expectations. Listen, when I was in my early 20s, I can remember just how far from full maturity that I was then, and I'm right. still maturing. So can you imagine coming into these platforms with the weight of responsibility, right? The access that you have when you're famous to not just positive ends, temptation is all around, right? And so at a certain point, the psychology of it all is definitely there on the table. And I think that when you look at a Michael Jordan, especially around the gambling, and you know, his opinion was, am I placing my family at risk? No. You know, do I have an addiction problem? I don't think so. Do I have a competition problem? Maybe. Am I addicted to competition there? But my thought is, anytime addiction is involved in anything, whether it's gambling, competition, I'm addicted to work, I'm addicted to success, there's psychology involved in that. And absolutely. All it takes is the right experience to refocus that addictive mentality, and you're addicted to the wrong thing. It can be destructive. Uh-huh. Yeah. And so I think for me, if you don't have, last thing I'll say is, we also don't yet know. I mean, I think that there were some healthy voices around him. And I love when he said, I always gravitated towards older people. Mm-hmm. For me, I think that might've been one of his ways of saying, okay, I know I have some issues. I know that I need to be smoothed out around the edges. My father being with me helped. He's not here, but I need somebody in that place.
Yeah.
Whether or not Michael Jordan was going to, you know, licensed therapists or counselors, we don't know. But I think that might have been one of his attempts to say, let me have some people in my pocket who can, when I say pocket, not money, but like in my space pocket, to be able to say, you know, all right, Mike, let's kind of think that way, or let's think that way, to kind of keep him centered. And so I think that there was that, you know, maybe you're talking about the late 80s, early 90s. So I don't know how popular themes of therapy and counseling were then.
Oh, not at all. Yeah, not. Correct. Yeah.
But I think that was maybe his attempt to say, let me have some voices of reason and counsel and wisdom around me because I know what I can get into and I know how things can go. So I think that was that. And we have to learn lessons about it now. You know, the conversations that they weren't having then, we have the opportunity to have now. The access and the availability I think it's a responsibility to learn from the past and to be able to dispel these stigmas, especially as Black men, to say, you know, how much different can successive generations be if mm-hmm. I make some hard choices now to sit in the hot seat, to have some difficult conversations, to kind of take some stuff, as David and Beverly Sitlogic say, cleanse the sanctuary of the heart. You know, there's some stuff going on. Let's talk through it. Let's properly be guided through this grief cycle. You know, mm-hmm. what are the traumatic experiences in my past that unbeknownst to me make me feel like this is the only way to lead?
Yeah, if I correct. Have this,
I might right. say, you know what? There's another way to lead, you know? Mm-hmm. I don't gotta use mm-hmm. this kind of language. I don't have to berate people, but I just don't know. I'm trying to keep it together in here. That's so right. So go ahead, Pastor Josiah.
Oh no, you said a mouthful. I'm looking at the clock. I would just add this, you know, for MJ, because of the unhealthy, I guess, mental state, the court was like his therapy, you know, and Richard alluded to it, you know, when the reporter came up and was asking him about some rookie that had just come into the league, he felt it was disrespectful that you're going to fly all the way to Chicago to ask me about some rookie. And so when the rookie plays him, he just wears it. He just locks him up. I don't even remember who the rookie was, but his mindset.
That's how bad it was, right?
Yeah, it was bad. You know, but his mental state, you know, mm-hmm. he wasn't where he should have been. You know, mm-hmm. so everything became a fight. Everything became disrespectful. Every you know, and we just got to be careful. You know, as leaders, you know, I always go back to leadership because that's what I'm in now, you know, that we don't, you know, make everything a fight. We don't make everything I've got to establish my dominance. Like what is that? Like why?
Yeah.
You know, which tells me a lot of us need to be in therapy. A lot of us right. need to make sure that we've got some friends. I've got a small group of guys who pour into me. Of course, my dad is my mentor and somebody that was in ministry 42 years and has seen it all just about. Wow. But I've got some personal, a little crew where they can, if Josiah's head's getting a little big, we know how to shrink it. We know how to bring him back. You know, now, praise God, they haven't had to do a whole lot of that
for me.
But you gotta have people who can pour into you, who can keep you mentally grounded, you know, so that the work isn't what's making me grounded. My worth is not based on my title. You know what I'm saying? My worth is based mm-hmm. on who God says I am, you know? And so I think Jordan needed,
that's good.
He needed a little bit more of those kind of people in his life. And maybe I think Phil Jackson may have helped him out in the, you know, yeah. you got the first threepeat and the second threepeat, you see Phil, the Zen master. Mm-hmm. Being the one yes. who tries to put people in certain spaces, so the last three aren't as don't seem to be as damaging per se. He apologizes to Kerr.
Yeah.
You know, he, mm-hmm. he recognized that Grant wasn't somebody that was going to back down to him. Grant never backed down to him, and so yeah. When people would stand up to him, he ended up respecting them. You know, after a while, but
I think just one last piece in connection with that is how far reaching this can go if it's not dealt with. And I think it was in the last episode. And for me, this was the most amazing part of the last episode that had me saying, no, this can't be real. When he said, talking about mental health and just being able to categorize, to be able to move beyond, he said, you know, you're talking about a guy who just name brand out of this world, right?
Yeah.
Passive income for his great-grandchildren, you know, like he's good. 6 rings. And he says to be able to try for number 7.
Oh, 7, yeah.
I just can't live with that. I said, Mike, Mike, let it go.
Let it go, man. Let it go. What?
Like no one's questioning your legacy.
No.
But again, if for some reason, I'm in the past and I'm creating what could have been. Like, yo, you got to deal with some stuff to be able to say it was great while it lasted. We got to move on and move forward in the future. So it's a lesson for all of us. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Maybe Richard, real quick, maybe he does think people are questioning his legacy.
Yeah.
Ron. So for the younger generation who, you know, they're just watching highlight reels versus those of us who watch the games
right.
Where Jordan was just dominated. There's some people who would say LeBron – you know, based on his leadership style, based on his work in the community, based on the schools, you know, and Claudia kind of tapped on it. We don't have time. Time is up. But Jordan wasn't nearly as iconic a social, a figure of social justice in his community, like a LeBron, like a Kareem, like Abdul, what's his name? I forgot the guy's name from Phoenix that went in and he became a Muslim and he went into dealing with issues of social justice.
Yeah.
You know, Jordan was even in their ballpark. So maybe there is some lingering because of that mental health I've got to do this docuseries. So maybe something is still there.
But you know, I'm sorry, we are way over time. But my thing was, you know,
it's okay.
Part two.
The greatest of all time. You know, why is it that somebody has to determine? Who are we to say who the greatest of all time is? You don't even know what all time is. You know what I mean? And I think that drives ultimate uber competitive people.
Yeah.
To come out the box trying to redefine or reassert what it was that used to be. We are all given a space of time in which to bloom and flourish. Right. And that is your great of all time. The greatest of all time.
She's preaching.
Free. You better
listen.
Free.
Listen. Tell her.
Ellen White, real quick. Ellen White, I was reading this yesterday. We've been going through last day events as a family. And Ellen White says something. She says that in whatever time you're in, and I'm paraphrasing, you need to put all your work into now. She said, don't be just laying back waiting on Jesus to come. She said, right now, whatever that now is, put your time in. Let people write about your legacy. Let other people debate whatever. You do what you're supposed to do. And for some reason, Jordan is still in a place where he feels like he could have done more, or maybe something is getting away from him. Maybe LeBron is, you know, so that's some very unfortunate, man. That's very unfortunate.
You know, I think that there is something to just not being satisfied. I think I talked with Rich about this a little bit. Mm-hmm. And I think that requires some therapy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
If you are someone where you are constantly achieving and you have achieved so much greatness, and yet, no matter what level of greatness that is, right? Whether you are a Michael Jordan, a Michael Jackson, a Beyonce, someone of that kind of human deity level type success and fame, or if you're just a regular person like us who have had, you know, some solid accomplishments, but if you cannot find any satisfaction, any peace, any just stability in what it is that you have attained. I suggest that you should be sitting on somebody's couch. And I think that what we see in the life of Michael Jordan in comparison to many of the other players, because we got to meet John Paxton, we got to meet Cartwright. You know, we got to meet so many individuals on this team, and these guys, the amount of peace that they have about what they did with their lives, how they contributed, what they did, they're good. They're like, hey, I had this amazing moment.
Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah. Michael Jordan, even Scottie Pippen was like, hey, it was amazing. I was glad to be a part of it. Michael Jordan was the only one that literally felt robbed of a championship seven. In his 50s, already been inducted into the Hall of Fame, is sitting here like, man, there was some unfinished business. And I just wonder how many Black men feel that pressure. Have this burden of I have unfinished work and I have things that I couldn't accomplish and I'm unsatisfied with what I have accomplished despite all of the family and friends and things that I have lost. I don't reflect on what I have lost in all the time. I'm still just unsatisfied with the next rung that I just didn't hit.
You know, Claudia, you know where that spirit comes from. So Isaiah 14.
Go ahead, Bishop.
Ezekiel 28. Yeah. He wanted to be like, I mean, he's right there. Ooh, Ellen White says that the glory of the throne bounced off of Lucifer's, you know, because he was made with all these precious stones, you know. But man, he wasn't satisfied, man. So that mindset comes all the way from the beginning. Wow. I just want to throw that in there.
That's so good. We can't have a Bible study on Lucifer right now, but that is so epic. I want to go there so badly, and I can't. Saints, just understand. Go in and study Lucifer, because that hit me in that sense of that mentality of I gotta have the next thing. I've got jewels in my throat, but that's not good enough. You know what I mean? Man.
Gold. Like,
yeah,
I can't. Yeah. Gentlemen, anyway. Thank you so much for
the honor.
Thank you for joining us. If you share with the people where they can follow you, how they can stay engaged with you, things like this.
You can follow me on Instagram, Pastor_Martin, PASTAH_Martin, MARTIN. Same thing for Twitter. My blog is www.richdmartin.com. There you can be inspired devotionally through my reflections. And I pastor the New Life Seventh-day Adventist Church, married to the husband of one wife, as they always say.
Right.
If you're ever in the Virginia area, come check us out and join our virtual worship experiences Sabbath morning, Saturday mornings at 11 on my Facebook page, Richard Martin. We'd love to have you.
Awesome. Awesome, man. Well, nobody really has to follow me. I'm just out there. I just believe in supporting ministry. I believe in supporting people who minister, man. So I'm one of those behind the scenes kind of guys. But I have been enjoying doing my little Wednesday worships. For those of you who know what I've been doing, just go to Facebook Live, you know, go to my Facebook page, man. And I just felt like people needed to be inspired to continue to worship, even if you're by yourself. You know, the Bible doesn't say you need a whole lot of folk to be with you while you worship, you know. And so I just love encouraging people. And, you know, you can find me out there just supporting everybody, you know, so Jesus can come back, man. We can get up out of here.
Amen.
I love it so much, man. Thank you guys again for coming. All of you, listen, this has just been another episode of What's the Message. Like I always say, it's a new topic, but, you know, same channel. We don't go nowhere. All right. So make sure you are following us on social media at Message 1898. You can subscribe to our weekly newsletter and our bi-monthly print magazine by visiting our website at www.messagemagazine.com. Okay. We've got so much content and so many things coming your way. Also, make sure that you subscribe to our YouTube page. We're trying to grow that right now. All of these episodes are available on YouTube for those of you who cannot join us on Facebook. All right. So I'm just saying, this is good stuff. We're gonna have the heavy conversations, but per usual, we're always gonna be relevant. And today was really special for me because we just got to have a whole lot of fun. All right. So I just can't wait to share even more content with you. We will see you next week. Same day, same time, just a different topic. Okay. So you all have a blessed rest of your day. Bye. Hey. Carmela, what are the five things you should not
in different places? But there was going around on social affairs and religious liberty, conscience and justice.
Now, to be clear,
in the North American division of Seventh-day Adventists. And so,
especially if we've gotten to the point where we are.
Well, as you know, we're just coming off Easter weekend and it's a new normal
day, and we're just going to have a good time. All right. So, welcome to
Carlton Bird on with us and Donna Green Goodman.